Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And I know that we said last week that we were going to do an episode on The Goblin Crown by Robert Hewitt Wolfe this week, which is his new book. We're going to postpone that probably a week.
Yeah.
But it'll probably be worth it. In the meantime, go check out The Goblin Crown. You can get it on Audible and Amazon and all that stuff. And, you know, I read it already, and it's very entertaining.
Download it on your Kindle, and while you're still recovering from your turkey coma, you can snuggle up with it and read.
Yeah, yeah. So, in the meantime, today what we're going to do is a commentary for maybe Joe Manosky's most acclaimed episode. I mean, I don't know. I guess he co-wrote Scorpion, so there's something there. But
I would say that this is the most beloved, though.
Okay.
I would say there's a definitely strong argument with this being, I mean, this is an episode that has become a touchstone for Star Trek and just general sci-fi fans across the board.
Yeah. It's also, I think it's like, you know, Manosky uncut in a lot of ways. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's Darmok. From season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation, episode 2, we're going to do a commentary for this episode. So sync up your tracks and your episodes or whatever it is to zero on the counter on your DVDs or Blu-rays or Netflixes or whatever it is. Netflix, by the way, as long as we're talking about streaming things, you know, we talked about Green Room a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
That's on Amazon Prime now if people want to check
sweet.
It out. And
totally worth it.
Starting December 1st, For the Love of Spock, which we also talked about on this show, is going to be on Netflix. So
perfect.
Check those out. Anyway, so get it already. If you're not watching the episode, don't worry about it. You'll be able to follow along with us without watching the episode perfectly fine.
No doubt.
All right. So I'll give a countdown, and then we will start this up. If you're ready, in
ready.
3, 2, 1, start.
All right.
So
and the Enterprise on a starfield.
Yeah, Captain's Log. The Enterprise is en route to the uninhabited El Adrel, whatever the hell. And
was that like the cheer in the opposing planet's football team? El Adrel, what the hell?
Something like that, yes. So here we have Captain Picard with his shiny, his very shiny in this episode, new jacket.
I love the jacket. I'm gonna come down firmly in support of the jacket.
Yeah, I love the jacket too. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, I was like, I want that jacket. I want that can be my, you know, like fall jacket, right?
Yeah.
But they never made them. Now they do make them, and it's like, yeah, that probably wouldn't work too well as a jacket, but you know.
Now you know we just had a shot because they're sitting here in the ready room talking, and it always seemed that no matter where you were in the ship, that the warp effect was like it was maddeningly inconsistent to me. It just didn't seem to work right. Like it seemed like the perspective was always a little off. I'm not saying that as a criticism. I'm just saying like it's got to be so maddening as an effects person to go through and try to figure out where you are on the ship and orient the warp effect accordingly.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if it's in the right place here. Because what this is to the, see, I don't know what port and starboard are, but it would be
left and right.
Right. So port is to the left.
Yes.
So this is on the starboard side of the ship. But are we seeing the back or the front?
Wait, no. Because if they're facing the ready room, they always exit stage left. So that would be port.
Wait, but they're not in his ready room. They're in the observation lounge, right?
I thought they were in the ready room. Isn't that the ready room? No, wait, no. You're right. He's, you know, it's somewhere.
The ready room is where Livingston lives. The observation lounge is where they have all of their staff meetings.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I was confusing the terms. My old age is catching up with me, I guess.
Boy, they, now, they, That jacket really is of course, shiny in this episode.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, of course we have the you know, the wonderful setup in the conversation before they encounter you know, the aliens in this episode, where Picard is talking about, you know, communication is all about patience, and I think we have that in good measure. And then they show up and they start talking, and the first thing they run out of is patience.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Oh, well, I mean, this is one of the weird things about this episode. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people are much more fond of the concept of this episode than, and like, that's what they remember. They remember, like, oh, this is the episode where this happens, and that's such a great idea, and it's such a great message and everything like that. And it's like, that's totally true, you know, but when you go back to watch it for like a second or third or fourth time, sometimes, you know, your patience might run thin, or at least mine does, because it's like, we know it all now, you know, and them trying to figure it out seems like it's taking them an excruciatingly long time. Like, okay, at this point, you know, watching this, I'm like, okay, I think I've got it. I think I understand. They're talking in metaphor.
Yeah.
He doesn't find that out until like the fourth act, you know, or something like that.
Yeah, but taking myself back in time to that first viewing, I think your point's valid, but taking myself back to that first time, you know, viewing it, this was such a wild experience. Like, the idea, the core thing that works for me best about this episode, hands down, is the fact that it is, you know, predicated on the concept that their technology is imperfect. Star Trek always has the fallback of, we're in an inescapable situation. Oh, wait, we'll do this, which is like this metaphor from 20th century Earth, and everything will be fine, and everything is fine. Whereas this is all built on, you know, just the very concept that, you know, that this is a conversation that I've had, you know, with a lot of people about the advantages, let's compare it with Star Wars, of a protocol droid versus a universal translator. Is this really teases out the fact that you're not going to know, just because you can translate the words, what the context, or even like, you know, innocent body language could be all sorts of wrong when you're encountering an alien culture. And I think that this plays on that, and that's why I think I can come back to it, is I like the what it makes me think about while I'm watching it.
Yeah, that's true. It's an interesting idea. That's something which Tarantino brings up in regards to Inglourious Basterds, and, you know, the idea that, you know, you'd see all these World War II movies where everyone's speaking English just with weird accents. Mm-hmm. And it's like, mm-hmm. one of the really interesting things about, you know, that war in particular is that there were a lot of instances where if you were, you know, in disguise or something like that, little gestures or whatever, you know, little differences, yes. in terms of culture and communication could be the difference between life and death. And, you know, that was something which most war movies don't really play with. And he definitely does play with it in that movie to great effect. That's kind of what's going on here too.
That's the best scene in Inglourious Basterds, to be honest with you.
I don't know. I think the David Bowie scene is the best scene myself, but
I don't know. I'm a big fan of that, you know, where exactly what you're talking about, the little gesture. That's not how we hold our hand when we say that. Like, that's pretty great. Because there were, I remember a story that one of the ways that they teased out German infiltrators was that Europeans hold their forks differently.
So
they would get in the mess hall and people would look over and they would know, because there's one guy holding his fork in the left hand instead of the right. And they were like, you know, it was like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Ah!
Yeah.
Oh, and the credits are over now. Here we, I mean, I guess if everybody's streaming this isn't going to be like, because we did a commentary on another thing recently where we had problems with commercial breaks.
Yeah, I don't think too many people are going to be watching this on BBC America or whatever.
True.
It is.
Good point. although we do fully support you if you did.
Well, aside from the fact that they probably trim stuff for syndication, you know?
Yeah.
Probably missing scenes. So, yeah. But yeah, yes, They'll figure it out. We missed it. You know, this is one of those things where, you know, like the Blu-ray, you know, they have like all these special features on it and everything. And there's this one thing which I never knew about, which now every time I see it, I'm like, it's so freaking obvious. But the scene where they beamed, you know, both people down to the planet, you know, and they beam Picard off the bridge. It's like a shot of the view screen, and you see, what's his name? I always want to call
him Winfield's character.
Yeah, Paul Winfield's character. It's not Darmok. It's like I forget what it is. Anyway, So they beam him off, and then the camera pans over, and you see Picard beam off. Those shots are actually shot in anamorphic widescreen and then panned and scanned because,
really?
Yeah, because that's how they're able to move the camera while doing a visual effect. Because usually,
I know that makes sense.
The camera needs to be locked down in order to do the effect. Well, here they're able to lock it down, but do the pan. And now every time I see it, I'm like, that clearly looks like, you know, 80s/90s era pan and scan, you know, for sure. Yeah. And someone online has taken a lot of those shots and like
turn them into their proper aspect ratio.
Yeah, the widescreen, and it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. There's a couple more shots in this episode that are like that, like when they're fighting the monster and stuff. So we'll try to keep an eye out for them.
Well, here's a question right now, because Picard and Paul Winfield's character are down on the planet, and so they're still arguing, you know, back and forth, and the communication isn't working quite right, and Riker's yelling at them, saying, you know, this could be interpreted as an act of war, and it's like, dude, obviously they don't understand you.
Yeah, your could be interpreted as an act of war, too.
Right. You might as well just be like standing up there being like, you know, purple licorice monkey backdrop. And, you know, you're making as much sense to them.
And there's a lot of, you know, that thing that people do where, you know, if they're talking to someone who doesn't speak the language that they're speaking in, they talk loudly and slowly.
Yes.
Because clearly that's going to help.
Yeah. You know, I had a terrible experience one time. My wife and I were actually over in Paris. She was there for business and I was just a hanger on. And so we went out one night and we were with this tour group and I didn't raise my voice, but yeah, I had just a tiny smattering of French and I was just trying to say to the people, we're going to take the metro home. And I'm doing everything where I'm like gesturing and like, and I realize like as I'm in it, I'm like, I must look like just a complete boob to these people. And I'm just trying, like just this pleading look came on my face, and I just like did like, you know, the prayer hands, and I was just like, just pointed at me and my wife, and just pointed at the metro, and the guy just like nodded. He's like, I got you. I was like, merci. You know?
Yeah. I had a similar experience when I was in Paris because we were going to all these different places, and we were like, okay, we need to, you know, learn a little bit of French, and we were like trying really hard to speak French, and then everyone's like, You want a pizza? Are you trying to say that you want a pizza? And we're like, yes, we are. Thank you. You know, and so at one point we're like, there's a McDonald's. Let's go to McDonald's, right? And we're like, this will be easy because obviously they speak English everywhere here. Clearly they're going to speak English at McDonald's. And we go in there and we're like, can I get a quarter pounder with cheese? And they're like, we have the metric system. We don't know what a quarter pounder is.
Oh, no, you were Vincent Vega.
Essentially, yeah.
And Royale like with cheese.
Yeah, the people in McDonald's could not speak any English at all. They're all just like, what are you? We don't know what you're saying. And we're like,
that
really?
Is funny. Oh. That is funny. But I, you know, coming back to the episode, something I will say that at the time that I watched it, realizing it was Paul Winfield in the makeup.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a wonderful, wonderful callback for, you know, I mean, this is back in the days before Easter eggs like this were a common thing. But to sit there and watch the episode and say, oh, wait, hey, that's Captain Terrell. That was a very neat, neat experience. I mean, Star Trek has always been known for using the same actors over and over again in different roles.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably not even meant to be an Easter egg so much. It's just like, oh, yeah. We can get Paul Winfield. Well, then, yeah, let's get Paul Winfield, you know? Because
there was some bit of trivia. I think for the longest time, Mark Lenard was the only actor to play three different alien races.
Yeah,
in
that
Star
could be.
Trek.
I know that there have been other people. I know like Von Armstrong has
Warner. And I think Warner was the first one to match it.
Yeah, and Mark Alimo has as well. Gold Ducat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. There's a number of them. And Susie Plaxton would have, because she was Dr. Salar, and then she was Kalar, and then she was Q. So.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. So there's a few people. Yeah, I mean, once they find someone who they like, they use them again and again and again.
So, okay, coming back to Picard's jacket here, because you pointed out the shininess earlier.
Yes.
Why do you think they backed off from the shininess?
I'm wondering how much of it had to do with, like, the glare on the camera, or how much of it just...
Oh, that's a good point.
It could have just made it look cheap, you know? I mean, I think that the suede looks better, right?
No, the suede definitely looks a bit classier. This is definitely pleather that he's wearing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, in the 24th century, they wouldn't be wearing animal hide.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if I know he gets his shirt cut. His shirt gets cut, and you just got the shirt, and it gets cut. But does he leave the jacket on the planet, or does he take it back up with him? I forget.
Will find out. I would be very disappointed for them to commit, you know, littering.
Well, it's not really littering. It's like you're in the middle of a big battle, and then, you know, you get beamed out of there, and it's like, I left my never mind.
It's cultural contamination, Mike. That's supposed to be against the Prime Directive. Aren't they supposed to go back at all costs to keep it from altering the course of history?
I mean, I guess they could. And this is another thing, you know, where it's that convenient Star Trek thing where, depending on what episode you watch, either you can, you know, defend yourself against the wild animal which is attacking you, or you cannot kill this single-celled organism even though it's going to wipe out everyone on the ship, you know?
Yeah.
I mean... It's very convenient what they choose to ignore and make a big deal out of on this show.
Oh yeah,
but you know that's sort of the nature of the beast, I guess.
I do want to say, even though it's not on screen right now, that the Temarian ship, I love the design of it. It's really, really cool. There are times where they've had alien ship designs on Star Trek where I'm just kind of like, you obviously had a week to think of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is one of the better, more successful designs that they've had.
Yeah, it's cool looking. Yeah.
You always have to wonder about Riker's hair, though. Why would they be so hung up on hairspray in the 24th century?
I mean, he definitely, you know, it was weird because, like, in the later seasons, there were, like, a few episodes where they're like, we need disheveled Riker, like in the episode where like he thinks he's going insane.
Yes.
And his hair is just like sticking up and it's all spiky. And then there's like another episode where you see like, it was it Parallels, where you see, you know, like alternate Riker when the Borg have destroyed and he's got spiky hair.
Yep.
And I'm like, that spiky hair looks cool. And then, you know, like right around that era, I went to my second convention and Jonathan Frakes was the guest. And that he had his spiky hair. That was his natural hairstyle, was spiky. They should have gone with that, you know, like with Sisko's baldness, you know?
He should have just changed his hair every season the way Worf did.
Yeah, yeah.
The evolutionary chain of Worf's forehead and hair has always been fascinating to me. And I think that it's a story, I really think that everybody... you know, gets hung up on TOS Klingons versus next gen and forward Klingons, or movie and forward Klingons with the ridges. Wouldn't it have been so cool if they had introduced an explanation that would have taken Worf's changing countenance into account and just said Klingons sort of evolve over time. Like it shows, like during their lifetime, it just continually changes, but they never address. I thought they had a great opportunity somewhere along the line, even if it's just a side book to explain that Klingons, the ridges just develop over time, and it's just a function of age. It's like us, you know, losing hair or what have you.
Yeah, we know that they're not bone. They've got to be like some sort of cartilage or something because they like bubble away in Enterprise. But yeah, I was just reading that 50-year mission book, and they were talking about shooting All Good Things and how they were going to have, you know, season one Worf and how his forehead has changed in addition to his hair. And they were debating whether or not to sculpt a new forehead for him to make it match with, you know, the stuff on All Good Things. But they decided that wouldn't make a lot of sense because it would be more distracting that it looks different from the present day stuff than, you know. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They made the right call.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got his little girl haircut right now. This is that, you know, the kind of like bob sort of thing. Yeah.
Now, here's a question for you. At this point, Picard is here, and he has seen the Temarian put these objects down and very deliberately put them in specific places. And he's already having trouble communicating with him.
Mm-hmm.
Would you touch this stuff? Or would you say, you know, this could possibly cause a problem if I'm going around touching things that this person I can't talk to effectively is placing them here on purpose? This might be do not touch territory.
Yeah. I mean, there is some stuff like that. Like, you know, I don't know. Like when it's Captain Dathan is his name. When Dathan, like, gives him the fire and he's like, thank you, you know? I mean, clearly at that moment, they're like, we're cool with each other. I think, like, if I were Picard, I would have taken the next step and been like, can I just come over and sit by you? You know? Like, are we at that level in our relationship yet? I think maybe, that might have been a missed opportunity on Picard's
Maybe that's
part.
What happens to the jacket, is he could have taken it off and he could have said, here's a stylish jacket that I offer you.
Yeah. And his shirt underneath is cool, too. You know, it's the gray, and it's got, like, the padded thing. It looks very warm and cozy. It looks like something that, you know, he would wear on, you know, like a brisk, like, winter's eve
it,
or something
it
like
does, that. It does, but he's wearing that while, you know, everybody else is wearing normal uniforms. Troy is obviously not dressed as warmly as he is.
No, not quite.
So would it be something like the Fantastic Four, where your suit sort of... Would they have the technology where your clothing would be intelligent clothing, and if it sensed you getting hot, it would, like, you know, something would trip and it would, like, cool you down, like a personal, like, Mr. Freeze suit, but it would keep you warm when you needed to be warm and cool when you needed to be cool?
I'm sure Under Armour has developed that technology by the 24th century.
You don't think that Nike beat them to it?
I don't think so. Under Armour seems to have the advantage when it comes to tech garments, right?
Yeah, you know, they definitely have the branding on their side.
Yeah.
Although I'm still, they haven't done anything Star Trek related, have they? They've got Star Wars stuff now, and they've got Marvel Studio stuff. Do you think Star Trek will ever get a line of active Under Armour wear?
No, I mean, it might get it. I mean, they haven't done that. I mean, it might get it, you know? I don't know. I don't know if CBS would, you know, CBS seems to like to do, like, a lot of things sort of, like, on a lower scale, like, in-house and stuff. Like, I think they released, like, biking shirts, like Star Trek biking shirts.
Not good enough. I want a good wicking running shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be pretty nice.
Yeah. See, like,
oh, there you go. There's he's just in the gray now.
I mean,
I
he
really
might
do
put
like
it back
the shoulders on that. That's a really good
texture. Yeah, it's nice, right?
Yeah.
And this is what they used for the action figure. The Playmates action figure was this uniform with the jacket. Though, and it's cool
is
because
shirt
like
actually tucked in.
Yeah, it's tucked in. It's blouse.
Now that's abnormal for Star Trek.
I guess that's the style for this particular garment.
Well, I guess when you're wearing the jacket, regulations say you tuck the shirt in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We don't want to look sloppy.
It's I kind of cool. Like every captain really has his or her own like specialty costume, or a lot of them do. I mean, Kirk had one. Obviously, he had the green tunic in the original series, and then he had his jacket in Star Trek V.
Yeah.
And then there's this
one
here.
Oh, yeah, the jacket in Star Trek V is great.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's this one here. And I thought one other captain had their own special thing. I forget. Maybe not.
Well, I like that type of stuff just because it's almost like an acknowledgement that people wouldn't, you know, that there would have to be variances in people's clothing. Like it's an attempt to make it a little less television. Because yeah. On television, everybody's always wearing the same thing. So,
yeah, you know, I know there was like the thing with the Star Trek. We have to stop and acknowledge.
Is that Ensign Leffler?
That is Ensign Leffler, the best character in the history of Star Trek, played by yes. Ashley Judd.
There you go.
Oh my God, so great, so great. And I love how they like introduce her in this little like nothing role here, and then a few episodes later, she you know gets her chance to shine in the game.
Now, I do want to say also that I always love whenever they have, you know, I need a resolution of 0.53 or any other sort of scientific jargony sort of thing, because as Star Trek fans, we sort of pride ourselves on, science, Star Trek and science. So much of what they're saying is just nonsense. It's just absolute nonsense what they're, you know, I need 40 millicochrans. Okay, first and foremost, Zefram Cochrane, not real. And what's a millicochrane? How did they determine what a Cochrane was? Is there a Cochrane? Do you say, I need 5 Cochranes right now, and then the companion misinterprets you and clones him and sends 5 Zefram Cochranes to your bridge?
Well, that's...
Just curious.
That's one of the things that they talk about in that book. You know, they talk to a couple of the science advisors, and they're like, we learned that our job was not to come up with, like, a reasonable scientific explanation. It was to come up with something that sounds like it makes sense, you know, in the context of the story and, you know, fits all these different little, you know, criteria. But they also talk about like the made up thing, you know, using like made up, because, you know, on occasion they would do something where they would like, you know, use I think it was in this book that it was something that I saw just recently or read or heard or something, but you know, they use something real, like, you know, that's 30 gigs of storage or something like that. And they're like, that's just, you know, such a massive amount. And then they're like, yeah, it doesn't work. And they're like, we better stick to millicochrans, you know? If you call it a millicochran, then no one can call you on it when they're watching it on Netflix, you know, 15 years later or whatever it is, you know?
Okay. I mean, that's the Predator.
Yeah,
the
Predator is coming up on one of these shots. If you see an awkward pan coming up soon, that's one of those anamorphic shots.
Okay.
I think this is it right here. No, we'll see. But
What I was about to say before the Predator showed up was Leffler does get a lot of camera love in her engineering moments. Like the camera zooms in on her, and it keeps panning over, following her around and everything. There's no way you can interpret that as anything but, this is a character I'm supposed to pay attention to for the future.
Which is weird, because that's not something that they ever really did. You know, I'm shocked that they had her on this episode. Isn't she on another one, too? I forget.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I mean, aside from the game. But, yeah. Yeah. I've talked about this elsewhere, but, like, Ashley Judd being in the game... Oh, that's one of those shots right there where it just panned over.
Oh, yeah. Electro rhinoceros man.
it's a crazy thing. I mean, it's such a like a weird alien being, you know, that it works, because it's not just like a giant monster from like the original series or whatever. It's right. You know. Yeah. But like Ashley Judd being in, you know, the game in particular, you know, like the other thing that she was doing at this particular point in time in her career was starring in like a bunch of like weird indie movies, right? So like, you know, I'm like, oh, Ashley Judd, she's amazing in Star Trek. I need to see everything that she's in. What's she in? And I go see these random movies like Normal Life or whatever, where I'm like, what is that? I don't know, but Ashley Judd's in it. And in the end, I end up getting exposed to like all of this weird indie cinema when I'm like, you know, 14 years old. So that was pretty great. And if you haven't seen Normal Life, check it out. It's
I haven't.
So good. Directed by John McNaughton, who did Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. It's her and...
I haven't seen that, but I would like to.
Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer?
Yeah, that's Michael Rooker, right?
Yeah, his first movie. I just went to the 40th anniversary restoration premiere because they're all from Chicago, like, you know, all those guys.
And I think I saw an ad for that in like a comic book or something.
Yeah. Check it out. It'll freak you out. It's terrifying. Especially if you need to, you know, take the train home after, you know, an 11 o'clock show in the city that you just saw this guy killing a bunch of people in. It's scary. It adds to it for sure.
Yeah, you know.
But yes, but he also directed Normal Life with Ashley Judd, and it's amazing. It's a really, really great neo-noir, and I highly recommend it.
Yeah, everything I've seen with Ashley Judd on the big screen has been, you know, very, I guess, mainstreamy sort of stuff. And you're right. The way they were walking in, they were definitely walking starboard to that lounge.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, but so they're walking in. So then that seems like that window would be facing towards, you know, they'd be looking out the front of the ship. So in that case, the stars were going in the wrong direction, right?
Right. Huh. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Unless, because there are two entrances to this room, and we've seen them enter from the other side, unless they weren't entering from the bridge in this. No, wait, no, it's still in the same place. No, because then it would be poor. I don't know. It was where it needed to be. And sure, I can guarantee you this many years ago, however many years ago it was that I was watching Darmok for the first time, all I cared about was, no, don't let the creature kill him. Leave Picard on the planet. And I paid no attention to the stars in the background.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a bunch of listeners right now who are like, you guys are so stupid. How do you not know this? Obviously, blah, 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 blah.
Didn't you read the technical manual? And the answer to that is yes, but it's been many years.
same here, yes. Big fan of the technical manual.
The technical manual is when I learned about the Heisenberg compensators for the transporter.
Yeah, yeah.
And that stuck with me for a very long time because I read the explanation for it and I said, it still doesn't seem to work, but okay, I'll go along with that.
Yeah. Those chairs on this set, I always wanted one of those chairs.
They look like they would be less comfortable than you think they are.
I remember
an upholstered chair is a dangerous thing, my friend, especially for those of us who are more hirsute and therefore we like breathable fabrics. That doesn't look very breathable.
There was a thing in like TV Guide in the 90s where they were like talking to like, I don't know, set designers or whatever about like the furniture on like iconic television sets, mm-hmm. and saying like, well, this is a table that we got from this place. It costs, you know, whatever. And they I just remember they did Frasier, like they had a bunch of stuff from Frasier. But the other thing that they did was like Voyager, and it had those chairs. And they're like, yeah, these chairs are like, you know, $800 or something. And I'm like, what?
Yeah. No, I used to work in an office furniture store, that stuff can get crazy expensive, man. And I mean, there are so many times where, not just Star Trek, but other sci-fi franchises where I'll be looking at the chair and I won't necessarily be able to nail the manufacturer, but I know that I've seen that chair on a showroom floor somewhere.
Yeah.
And I just think to myself, you could have tried a little harder to dress that up, guys. Just a little harder.
Yeah. But I love that. I love like seeing like real world stuff in movies and being like, like the silverware that they use in Voyager and Enterprise, which is the same silverware from 2001. And it's like, you can buy that silverware. That's awesome.
True.
You know, it's expensive, but you can buy it.
You know, have they ever had, we should do an episode focused on the silverware of Star Trek.
Yeah.
The silverware manufacturers of Star Trek.
Yeah. I mean, there's like those mugs on Deep Space Nine, you know, that's like the holy grail for a lot of people. I've got one that the company has not been, you know, smart enough to cater to the fans and be like, if we make the styles that we had in the 90s, we would sell billions. But, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Now, here's a question. Why doesn't Picard give his coat to the person who's obviously in some sort of shock and probably needs the warmth?
Well, have you seen the coat? Would you give it to the guy who's just going to die anyway?
I would. Yes, I would admit that I wouldn't want to get blood on the coat. Although I would imagine it would probably, dry cleaning's probably very easy in the 24th century. Do you think they use transporter technology for it?
You don't know what kind of blood that guy has. It looks like it's white. See?
Yeah, that's true.
Unlike his head, it looks like he's got white blood coming. I mean, you don't know what that's going to do.
That can't be blood, though. How on earth would that carry oxygen? That doesn't make sense.
I don't know.
Okay. It's not necessarily blood. It could be some sort of something else.
Can white blood not carry oxygen?
I seem to recall, and I could be wrong. I'm sure that there's somebody else flipping out in the audience right now. I seem to recall somebody telling me a while ago that the color of blood is determined by, like, it couldn't be certain colors because carrying oxygen would change the blah, 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 blah. They may have been speaking only in terms of human physiology, for all I know. Blood is like bluish green when it loses the oxygen for us.
Right, and it's weird, like blood, which is like closer to your heart, is like a darker shade of red than blood at the extremities or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's, yeah, I mean, but who that has to do with like the chemical makeup of blood, right? So, I mean, who's to say that his blood doesn't have like a different chemical makeup?
The only thing I remember about the conversation, because it honestly wasn't, it wasn't something that I considered so important to remember everything about, was that it was in the context of Star Trek VI, and the person was telling me that they possessed the knowledge that Klingon blood couldn't be purple if the Klingons were going to be in the same environment that we were.
Hmm. Interesting.
The reasoning had something to do with oxygenated blood and those sorts of things.
But Vulcan blood.
Blood
can be green, though.
Well, I mean, like our blood is blue green when it loses the oxygen, so maybe it has something to do with the, I don't know, physiology of a Vulcan or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
No. Although in the theatrical cut of Star Trek VI, they never explain the red blood from the Klingon who gets killed.
Wait, do you ever see the red blood?
Yeah, you do. Mm. You see the red blood pooling next to him, but and you get. What is it? But yeah, anyway.
I'm pretty sure I've seen the theatrical cut of Star Trek VI twice. Once when the Blu-ray came out, and then once probably the same day when I watched it again with...
Wait, is the theatrical cut on the Blu-ray?
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
Are you sure? Does it have a conversation where... Scotty says the very out of character that Klingon B word didn't shed one bloody tear, because that's not in the theatrical cut.
I am 100% positive that the theatrical cut is on the Blu-ray, because that was the whole thing, was because they couldn't put the director's cut of Star Trek the Motion Picture on Blu-ray.
Yeah.
They decided that the set that they would release would be a celebration of the theatrical experiences of these movies, and would be the theatrical cut of all the movies, which is why it did not have the director's cut of Star Trek II or Star Trek VI, just the theatrical, which is why I had to buy freaking Star Trek VI off of iTunes in order to watch it in HD and the proper aspect ratio.
I really need to know there are a couple of specific scenes in the version on the Blu-ray. Did they have the scene with Rene Auberjonois coming in and saying, "Frankly, sir, we can clean their chronometers"?
Is he in that scene or not? I mean, I don't know.
Because that was not in the theatrical cut I saw back in 1991 when I was sitting my butt in that movie theater.
See, I thought that was in there, but they didn't have the part where they pull off the mat. Anyway, I don't know. But it is the theatrical cut. I'm 100% positive on that, because it was a huge, huge deal. And it is the reason why I would always watch Star Trek VI on DVD until it was released on iTunes in HD.
Now, see, everybody everybody would give, say, a certain Mr. Lucas a lot of gumption for not being able to track down original versions of movies. But I swear to you, they have never released the full-on, straight-up theatrical cut of Star Trek VI on videotape or disc. Because when they released the videotape, it was actually a big thing that they added 3 minutes back in.
Yeah, no, that they did that. They did that, and they did it on the Laserdisc and everything. And then they finally released the theatrical cut on Blu-ray, and that's the only...
Until I, you know what, I'm going to be a doubting Thomas here, and until I see it with my own eyes, I'm calling BS on that, because I'm willing to bet that they're saying that this is the theatrical cut, but it isn't.
No, it is, because I remember watching it and being like, oh, that scene's missing too.
Okay.
You know?
All right.
It definitely is, because it doesn't have, you know, them pulling off the mask or any of that stuff.
So it's this, and it's a straight up, okay. All right, we've gone down the whole rabbit hole here that has nothing to do with the very moving scene where the Temarian commander has just passed away after communication has been figured out.
It's okay to go off topic. Yeah, I know. And hey, if you want to listen to, since we're on a commentary and speaking about commentaries, if you want to listen to one of the very best commentaries, where they're not afraid to go off topic, by the way, check out the commentary on the Blu-ray for Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, which features Ira Stephen Bear and friend of Trek FM, Larry Nemechek, together.
Oh, cool.
Awesome. It is awesome.
Another reason to buy it. All right,
frankly, the only reason to buy it. So, because of that whole theatrical cut thing. Yes.
I want to have the experience I had back in 1991, man. Come on.
Good for you. Good for you. And that's fine. And I can see, for historical purposes, getting to see it that way in its, you know, 35 millimeter aspect ratio and whatever is all well and good. But if I'm going to watch Star Trek VI, I'm going to watch the director's cut, you know?
Okay. See, this is funny. This is very funny to me, because this opens up that whole argument about Lucas and the special editions and director's cuts and stuff like that, because people cut him zero slack when he says, this is the version I want everybody to see. Everybody says, no, I want the original version. And here, everything's flipped, where I'm saying, I want the original version of Star Trek VI. I don't actually care if they never release it. I just want to, like, sit down and remember seeing it when I was a wee lad.
No, see, here's the difference for me, right? With Episode 4, he can do whatever the heck he wants, and I don't care. So he does keep his jacket. Okay, well, that's good to know. But the thing is, Lucas says that about, you know, two movies that he didn't direct. So, you know, it's like Richard Marquand isn't like, I like the special edition, because he never saw the special edition because they made it after he died, you know?
God rest his soul. Yes.
Exactly.
But, yeah, yes. Well, okay. That question of authorship is a whole other thing. But the original Star Wars, you know? If the director says that's his version, right?
That's the version I'm going to watch. I'm going to watch the special edition or the Blu-ray cut or whatever is the most recent cut of that movie. That's what I am going to watch. It would still be nice to have the original cut around for historical purposes, though.
It would be really nice to have the original cut around for historical purposes. I agree. Yeah. So. And that's what I'm saying about Star Trek VI.
I agree with that. And I'm glad that it exists. Would I buy it if it wasn't in a set with other movies that I wanted, or if it didn't have an audio commentary by Larry Nemechek and Ira Stephen Bear? No. But it is worth it just for that, though. So, yeah.
I love this Picard just taking command of the situation.
He's like, I figured it out, guys. They're all like, you know, whatever. And, oh, by the way, we missed the scene where Data and Troy are trying to figure it out. And they're like, okay, Siri, tell me. They like do a Google search. And then, like, it's like this big, long scene. And, like, the big, like, revelation is like, oh, if we search for both Darmok and Tanagra together, then we only get one result. And it's like, I'm sure back in 1990 or whatever it was, that's like, oh, yeah. You know, but like watching that now, it's like, okay, yeah, we figured that out like 15 minutes ago, guys, because there's one of those shots. You see it right there?
Oh, yeah.
That pan scan? Yeah. But yeah, and I mean, I guess that's kind of, I mean, I don't know, and that's, I mean, part of it is just that we've gotten so used to, you know, using search engines. But I think another part of it is just like they should have figured that out a long time. I mean, regardless of that, it's a very simple, you know, and that scene is like really long and drawn out, and that's like the problem that I have with this episode. Even though I think it's a very good episode, it's that, you know, it has some pacing issues, and I think the problem is that once you're aware of the outcome, you're kind of ahead of it every step of the way. And I know that sounds like it's cheating or whatever, but I mean, that's like not the case with something like, let's say, The Sixth Sense, you know, where there's, you go back and you watch it and you see like a lot of, you know, things that you might not have picked up on, you know, with the knowledge that you have, you know, going into it this time. I know that's an extreme example, but with here, I mean, I think a lot of it really is, you know, their journey of trying to figure out what the deal is with this language. And, you know, there's so much like plotting going on, you know, in terms of that like when you know it already, it's just kind of boring, you know?
Yeah, I want to throw something out here too. As somebody who worked in a historical preservation library, it drives me nuts on Star Trek when they're holding these antique books and they don't have the gloves on. I know that sounds very strange, but for me, I worked for a time. It was called the National Trust for Historic Preservation Library or something like it. It was in college, so that's why the name is fuzzy. But you didn't so much as touch a book, like even the cover, without your special gloves on. And Picard's like, oh, here's this, you know, ancient book from, you know, like hundreds of years ago. And, you know, I was tossing it around and just, I mean, come on, man. Or do you think that they have some sort of magical force field, like the belts from the animated series on it or something like that?
Yeah, they probably have some sort of like spray on stuff where they don't have to worry about like fingerprints or dirt or whatever, you know?
What still bothers me is an historical preservationist to think that, I mean, that would have changed. I mean, the paper, how would the paper react? Anyway, unimportant.
Don't they have that now with like certain things, like with paintings and stuff, where like when they're preserving things, they can, you know, use some sort of, I don't know. I think they have that stuff now, and to some degree. Obviously, you can't touch it, but, you know, it's the future. Yeah. It's the future.
I mean, it's obviously they have the antique-y looking book, just so you know that it's an old book, but I would think that, I don't know. I mean, why couldn't you just read it on a, you know, your pad?
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Yeah. On the whole, pretty good episode. I know we got off topic. You know, we didn't talk that much about Joe Manosky, but I think that it is like a good example. I think maybe the best example of what Manosky brings to the table. You know, this sort of like weird, crazy, high concept sci-fi that we're really not used to seeing even on Star Trek. You know, and you know, he does a lot of weird stuff, and occasionally he'll do, you know, masks or whatever when it's like, that doesn't work at all. But then he'll do Darmok, which works really, really well. And, you know, I think that it's exciting to have someone like that involved in the show, someone who's willing to think way, way, way outside of the box, because you never know what he's going to come up with, you know?
Oh, yeah. Completely agree. It is exciting that he's going to be working on Disco, because this is what made Next Gen work so well, is like you said, even if you weren't nuts about the episode, they were at least pushing things and trying something that you hadn't seen before. And I think he's a good guy for that.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Well, it's been fun talking about Darmok today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Don't watch any of the extras on the first disc, because they're all duplicated over the second disc. So then that way you can just watch them in order and not have to worry about, oh, well, let me skip this one because I watched it on the first disc and do all that.
Wait, to clarify, they have all the special features in column A on one disc, and then all the special features of column A plus column B on a second disc?
That is correct.
That makes no sense to me at all.
I know. I was very confused when I sat down to watch it.
Melodic Treks.
Matter? I barely know her. Oh, it's painful. I don't know. Are you snowing me?
No,
you snowing
me? Painful just saying Remus and blah, blah. I felt myself falling asleep. I felt like it was my parents were telling me a good night story where you were giving me that track listings there that... like.
Does it still McFly?
That's one of my favorite ones.
Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Within about 15 seconds, you texted me back, Dr. Giggles, we have to do Dr. Giggles. And my question for you is,
yes,
why did we absolutely have to do Dr. Giggles?
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions, and that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and discover what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and you can just download the thing from our website too if you want. All right, we have to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you.
If you want to be like Norm, Jeff, and Chris, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. That's patreon.com/trekfm, patreon.com/trekfm. There you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you. So, yeah, head on over there and help us out, and we really appreciate your support. If you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for me as Kessel Junkie, or you can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds. You can find me co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, or you can also find me co-hosting a show that should be near and dear to your heart too, Mike. Great Shot Kid.
Yes, Great Shot Kid is our show on the Nerd Party Network where we do the same thing that we're doing here, only for Star Wars creators instead of Star Trek creators. So head on over to thenerdparty.com and check us out. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, or you can find me right here on Trek FM producing From There to Here, which is Trek FM's daily rewatch of Star Trek, where we look at all 729 episodes in celebration of the 50th anniversary.
And let me just throw this out here, right here. All 729 hours and everything, and he still gave you a commentary for Darmok today.
Yeah, which is an episode that I covered on From There to Here.
That's right.
And I said a lot of the stuff that I said here, so I apologize for repeating.
I certainly hope you didn't, because I don't think that anybody else really got into an argument about the Star Trek VI director's cut versus theatrical cut.
That's true. Yeah. We didn't do that, but we did talk about Ensign Leffler and the jacket and how awesome things were.
The jacket is really, it's worth talking about.
So is Ensign Leffler. Come on.
True.
All right.
Fair point.
So that's about it for this week. We'll be back next week, and we're not 100% sure what we're talking about, so it'll be a surprise. It'll be a mystery.
Read the Goblin Crown anyway.